Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace. It's a podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
Doing great as well. So here in Poland right now, we have summer. I guess you have winter right now, being in the southern hemisphere. So does that mean that you're getting an extra amount of coding done and a lot of things going on indoors? Or is it still business as usual, given your climate?
No, very much indoors this time of year, although it's been very spotty. Like, we had a couple of weeks of cold temperatures, which I know for you is a joke, but it went all the way down to like 8 degrees Celsius. So that's ridiculously cold.
8 degrees. Sounds like a warm spring morning for us here.
Exactly. So we had a couple of weeks of up and down like that. And then we had like close to 30 degrees another week. And now it's kind of in the middle. So it's all over the place this year.
Right. I get it. It's funny, we usually share screenshots between each other when it comes to the weather warnings. I know that weather is one of those podcast topics you should never talk about, but we're just doing a little bit of an intro here, all right? This is not the main topic, the weather, but we like to share these screenshots because sometimes I get like a warning in my weather app, like warning for extreme weather, it's going to be 26 degrees, and this is Celsius, by the way. Then, you know, I send that to Rambo, and Rambo is like, what warning? What's that? 26? That's normal.
And of course, I get extreme low temperature warnings, and it's like 15.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. Like with everything in life, it's about what you're used to, right? Like, It's the same, you know, bringing it back to tech here. You know, when you're working with one language or in one environment or something, like something else can seem like completely extreme or weird or different. And then, you know, once you're used to it, it's just your new normal, right? And it's the same with the weather, and it's the same with so many other things, I think. So, yeah, it's funny how it works that way.
Definitely.
So, Rambo, what do you have for our actual tech topic besides the weather for us this month?
So, I would like to talk about open source, and more specifically, open source in the age of AI agents and AI coding.
That's a very interesting topic, and I feel like it's a topic that a lot of people have opinions on, and I myself, and I'm curious to hear about your take on the topic. I feel like my opinion just like changes all the time based on, you know, what's currently going on in the world of AI and especially how it relates to open source and so on. So can you give your kind of opening statement here, if you will, to this topic?
Right. So it's a really difficult topic to talk about because, like many things these days, everything is so polarized, right? So you have extremes, and if you try to be balanced with your opinions and your position on something, pretty much you'll be hated by both sides, right?
Right.
So if I have a more balanced view on AI, for example, people who hate AI will hate me because I don't hate AI like they do, and they will think that I'm one of those people who thinks AI should be doing everything and it's the best thing since sliced bread. And the other side will think that I am one of those people who hates AI. So it's really difficult to talk about. And this has also had an impact on how I position myself in my open source projects, because my real opinion, please, people, be kind when interpreting what I'm about to say. But so I've been getting every now and then pull requests on my open source projects that are clearly someone just told an AI agent, write a pull request to this project that implements this thing, and that's it. So there was no actual care and work put into it other than computer work and water, I guess. And I really don't like to get those because the thing is, I take my open source projects quite seriously. except those that are like just a throwaway experiment or sample code or something like that. Those I don't take that seriously, but like my quote-unquote real products that happen to be open source, I take those very seriously. So any code that gets checked into those, I feel responsibility for that code going forward. And because of that, I am quite picky about what I will accept as a pull request. So I, even way before AI coding agents existed, I would typically not accept a pull request that implements like this huge feature that changes every aspect of the project or adds like a major new feature that touches several places and systems in the project, because I would end up being responsible for maintaining that. The thing is, before AI coding agents, those types of pull requests were rare because it actually required a lot of effort to make those pull requests. But nowadays, you can get Claude, Fable, or GPT Sol in like the max setting and tell them to do something, and they will do it no matter how tricky it is. And they do not care if it's a pull request that changes 10,000 lines of code in the project. So in general, I'm having a hard time figuring out how to approach this in my projects. And the reason I said my real opinion is because I haven't been placing warnings or things like that in my projects, because I don't want people to read that and think that I am someone who hates AI or someone who loves AI, and they will hate me and my project because of their own strong opinions about X or Y. So it's really complicated, John.
It is indeed really complicated. And I would say that this extends even beyond open source to like also working within a team, because since AI is so, not only is it like polarizing in a way where some people are like super excited about it and other people are really against it, but it's also sometimes difficult to know exactly how much to use it, even if you are like a person who is somewhere in the middle on that scale, right? Between love and hate. Knowing how to be productive with it, knowing how to get good quality out of the code that it generates. There are so many still open questions, because this has all happened so incredibly fast. And me personally, as someone who, like I mentioned there in the intro, like my opinion on AI kind of swings back and forth a lot, because, you know, sometimes you read about something that really makes you angry about the AI world or the way AI is currently being pursued by these large companies. And sometimes, you know, you get this really cool experience where you were able to build something with AI in code that you either weren't able to do before because you didn't know that particular thing, or because, you know, you did it in a new language, or because it just helped your research and enabled you to do something much quicker in a way where previously you wouldn't have done it at all because it's just for a hobby project or something. And then you get this like amazing feeling that, oh, AI is so enabling as a technology and it helps me do all these cool things. So, you know, this is a very complex topic and it has so many different pros and cons. And just like you, I am not in either the kind of love or hate camp, but rather, you know, it tends to swing week by week, even sometimes day by day or hour by hour, depending on how AI is applied, because I really think that is the key here. Like, how is it actually applied?
Yeah.
I think, you know, regardless of the ethics or like the, you know, environmental impact and so on, you know, and all of these kind of bigger questions around it, if we just look at it as a tool, I think most people would agree that it can be useful in certain contexts. Let's just say that as the most kind of diplomatic way possible, right? Like, you know, some people like to use it a lot. Some people like to use it little. Some people like to use it kind of selectively. Personally, I try to use it purely kind of as an assistive thing. I don't want to be a person, at least not right now, who is like letting AI kind of drive my development work. I want to be in the driver's seat. I want to be the one actually writing the code itself, and I'm using AI to help me rather than like spawning, you know, 10 different agents and having them go work on tasks. And then I'm just a project manager. I don't really want to be a project manager. I want to be a developer, right? So right. That's kind of my personal view on it. But different people have so many different views on it. And even within a team or in open source, like you're talking about, it can be really tricky when these different views or these different ways of using AI clash, where some people might look at those open source pull requests that have been generated with kind of quote unquote low human effort as like a great positive thing. Look, we can do these great contributions to this open source project and it didn't take me almost any time at all. And now I can have this new feature. And isn't that great? While you might look at it from a completely different perspective as the maintainer and be like, well, this is a huge amount of code that has been changed and clearly it hasn't been really scrutinized by a person. So how can I kind of trust it? And that's, I feel like, where the conflict really starts to come into play of like, you know, there are two different people with two different perspectives, kind of all being enabled kind of by AI and the additional output that you can get from a developer's point of view. And then kind of how to handle that and how to make sure that it's integrated in a good way into a project and that the quality of the code remains high.
Exactly. And that brings me to another aspect of my conflicts with this topic, which is I also don't want to sound like a gatekeeper and like I'm saying like, oh, you're not a real developer if you use a coding agent. But the thing that's been happening and I've seen happen in my own projects is, I mean, let me go back a little bit. Two things I really like about coding agents is, one, they are great assistants to developers like you and I. Like, we are developers. We've been doing this for decades at this point, and we know our way around, especially Swift code. But if you have this... it's not another pair of eyes, right? Because it doesn't have eyes, but you know what I mean. It's kind of like having
another pair of GPUs.
Yeah, so it's kind of like having a little virtual colleague that can help you find issues and debug things. One of my favorite things to do is use Codex, which is my agent of choice, to help me debug and explore crash reports and things like that. So we can use them very effectively like that. It's not true of every professional developer, but I would say it's true of most professional developers who have adopted these tools. They have figured out where they're good for, what they are not good for, and how to tame those tools so that they don't go haywire and change 50,000 lines of code in one pull request, even if they are writing the code. But the other side that I also really like is people who are not developers at all, who have always wanted an app for the Mac, for example, that does something that they've always wanted, an app, they can now build it for themselves. And I think that's really cool. And I am not going to be the one here saying, oh, all apps should be made by professional developers, because I really don't like that type of gatekeeping. Where these two things collide, though, is when someone who, let's be honest, does not know what they're doing because they're not a developer, opens up a pull request on one of my repos with a clearly coding agent written. Even like the pull request text itself is written by the coding agent, which is very easy to tell. And the code, of course, because they are not a developer. That's where I actually have a problem. And I don't think it's gatekeeping. If you think of it like, imagine, I know, John, you are a great cook. You cook at home, right? And
right.
It's pretty good. I've seen pictures.
At least it looks good on pictures, right? Tastes pretty good too, I would say.
Yeah, so I like to think that I cook decently well, but it's not like we're gonna walk into a restaurant kitchen and start making dishes and serving them to customers, right? Of course, these analogies always break because as far as I know, there's no open source restaurant where you can just enter the kitchen.
That would be cool, though. That is maybe an interesting new concept you've just invented there, Rambo, an open source restaurant.
Right. So, I kind of feel like that when that happens. And also, to some extent, I like, I feel bad for just rejecting things outright, because even though these are low effort contributions, someone has put some level of time into knowing about the project enough to want to contribute to it. And I always come from a perspective that they're doing it in good faith and that they have good intentions. But I just can't bring myself to accept those types of contributions, because it's my project and I am going to be responsible for maintaining it going forward. And it's not like if someone who is not a developer made a pull request to one of my projects that's really good, and I can't even tell that it's been made by a coding agent without pretty much any human input, I would probably just accept it, not even knowing that the person is not a developer. But the thing is, it's very easy to tell when that's the case. And I've been getting those more and more lately. And I know that at least a few high profile open source projects have basically shut down their pull requests because of that. And basically, like, only registered previous contributors can open new pull requests. And I really don't like that, because I don't like the gatekeeping aspect, but I completely understand why really high profile projects would want to go that route. And I really don't have any solution to propose here. I'm just venting, basically. This is my therapy session, John.
Well, we, the listeners and I, are happy to help you with this therapy session. you bring up some really good points there. And I think, you know, we've discussed it in the past as well, that there's this fundamental tension in open source in general, which is that when someone submits a pull request, that is a good thing. You know, that's like a fundamental part of open source, that you can collaborate and improve a project together, which is really, really amazing that we can have that. But at the same time, like, whenever someone makes a contribution, the maintainer then needs to have time and energy and, you know, willingness to actually, like, review that code and then integrate it. And then, perhaps even most importantly, maintain that code going forward, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've talked about this in the past, where you might get a pull request for a new feature that is not something that you really want to maintain, but at the same time, you can kind of see the value of this new feature being added to your project. So you're kind of, should I accept this or shouldn't I? And now we're kind of adding AI to that discussion as well. It's like, especially if it's a larger change, like, is this something that I want to spend my time, or can even spend my time if it's a large one? Do I even have time in my schedule this week to look at this, like, if it's a larger change? And, you know, I mentioned earlier that this kind of problems or that AI creates, it solves some problems, but it creates other problems. It also exists within teams where, you know, the more and more code that we generate using AI within a team, the more time is being spent in general on code reviews instead of actual coding, right?
Yeah.
And some people might like that and be like, oh, I love doing code reviews. I grab my coffee and a nice snack and I read some code and then I merge it. Great, right? But some other people might not like code reviews at all. And now all of a sudden they have to do a lot more code reviews because there's a lot more code being generated. And that kind of makes their work less fun. So again, like, there are these tensions that exist that are hard to resolve, because, like you say, I completely agree with you. You don't want to be a gatekeeper. You don't want to say, like, oh, you know, someone who is a new developer cannot use any tools to assist them creating their first pull request, for example. That wouldn't be productive at all. And I think both you and I are very much in favor of helping beginners. I mean, we've both dedicated a big part of our careers to helping people, like helping developers, building tools, even like sharing advice on this podcast and other shows and so on. Like, we are really much in favor of helping developers, you know, improve, and improving ourselves also in the process. But there's always that trade-off, right, of how much time can you spend on that versus, you know, if this code has been generated not by a person but by an agent, and it is, again, a larger thing, and it's not maybe something that you might want to integrate yourself, it can be really tricky to find the time and energy to dedicate to actually reviewing and integrating that into your project. So, yeah, it is a hard problem to solve. I don't think there's any kind of policy you can create on your project that will just solve the problem, because, like you say, if you shut down pull requests and make them restricted to only, like, verified maintainers, then that becomes really hard for people to get into open source. And we definitely want more and more developers to get into open source, because the more people are into open source, the better, right? Like the more we share our code and share our knowledge and work together as a community, the better. I absolutely believe that. So it is really tricky, and I don't even have a, you know, clear go-to solution for this problem. I think it has to be kind of on a case-by-case basis. And I think as a maintainer, it needs to be okay for you to give that feedback and say, hi, I can see that this has been generated with a coding agent. Could we perhaps break this up into like smaller pieces? Or can you maybe explain what your idea is behind this so we can come up with a solution? Again, that also requires your time to like engage in that discussion and so on. But, you know, I think probably that's the best way forward for now, to kind of figure out, like, you know, is there actually a person behind this who really does want this integrated? And if so, what's their plan? And can we somehow find a way to kind of polish this pull request up and maybe break it up into separate pieces that will enable us to merge it in a kind of responsible way?
Yeah, and it actually has happened in at least one of my projects. I got a very large pull request by someone who is clearly not a professional developer, but they seemed very keen on actually participating in the process and not just shoving everything into an AI agent and having it fix all the things. So I actually engaged with that pull request, and the first thing I requested was to reduce the scope, basically, of the pull request, which did happen. And then later, I realized that the scope was still a little bit too large, and we managed to trim it down. And it's in the final stages of review, and I do think it will end up being merged. So it's not like it's always a disaster, but then the person behind the pull request who's using the coding agent has to actually put in the effort. So if people are listening, whether you are a developer or not, and you are thinking of doing that sort of contribution, I would generally recommend, first of all, check if the project has any guidelines about coding agents. And if they're like, oh, you can't use coding agents, don't use coding agents. And if the only way you can open up a pull request is by using a coding agent, then don't open up a pull request. I think it's important to respect people's choices.
Yeah, exactly. Then you always have the option of forking, like respect the license, of course, but then you can use your coding agent on your fork. Like that's your option at that point, I would say. And that has been in general also a go-to kind of answer for me, as I've been not able to spend as much time on open source as I would have wished in the past years. Is like, if someone wants to significantly change a project of mine, then forking it, adding those features and maintaining it yourself, I think is the best way forward. Because again, it's like, you don't want to rely on someone who doesn't have the time to maintain all of these new features. If you really need them, then it's probably better just to fork the project and add those features yourself. And then you can maintain them and iterate on them, and you have more freedom at that point. But of course, then you occasionally might have need to synchronize with upstream. So it does come with some downsides. But again, it's a trade-off, right? Yep. That's in general, when you're using someone else's code or depending on it, have that dependency, you know, that is the trade-off that you accept. And I think with coding agents, it's no difference. It's the same kind of attitude that I think you need to have as a contributor and as a maintainer. Is like, if it's incompatible, like if you as a maintainer have decided, I don't want any AI generated code in this project at all, which is, you know, definitely within the rights of a maintainer to decide, then, you know, the people depending on that project will have to adapt to that and decide how they want to deal with that.
Exactly. I have my own fork of Publish, for example, that I've been using for years. And I sometimes sync with upstream, and that's fine.
And that's fine by me.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like some people have the impression that forking a project is like a hostile takeover of the project and you are stealing the
right
people. That's what open source is about. As long as you respect the license, everything is fine.
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things about open source, is that you can take something, again, respect the license, but you can take something and modify it to your to how you want it to be, right? I've done that with so many open source projects in the past, like, and I think that's one of the most beautiful things. It's not a product that you have to use as is. You can customize it. And again, like AI agents for even people who are not developers can be a great tool here, like where you can actually make those customizations, even though you might not be like, you know, have decades of experience working in that particular language. So again, pros and cons.
Yeah. So, and just to finish up my recommendations. So first one, check if the project allows it. If they do not disallow it, if you do open up a pull request, be mindful of the size. It's easy to see the number of lines, especially the number of lines added. I mean, if you open up a pull request removing 10,000 lines of code and the project still works and has all the features, that's amazing. But if you're opening up a pull request that adds a bunch of lines of code, I would say try to keep it below 1,000 if you can. That's generally my suggestion. If the project has issues, check the issues to see if the feature you're implementing or the bug you're fixing has been filed as an issue. And if it's not, create an issue first before implementing it. If the project does not have issues, many of mine don't, but they have the discussion section, you can open up a discussion post. Hey, I'm thinking of opening a pull request to implement this. And then you can discuss. And please do not use AI to write your messages in discussions, in issues, in pull requests. I think that's the bare minimum you have to do, is write the messages yourself. It doesn't matter if maybe English is not your first language, like it isn't mine. If there are some mistakes, that's not a problem. People get around that. And if you are self-conscious, use like a grammar checking thing, but do not use AI to write your pull request messages or your issue messages or any messages in GitHub repos or in life in general, I would say, because it's very easy to tell and it does not sound good in my opinion. So that, and also especially and ideally if you are a developer, check the code. Do not just shove a pull request for someone else to review. Review the code yourself first and make the necessary adjustments as needed.
Yeah, because really what we want to avoid is like AI slop, right? Like, yep. We don't want really low effort, just AI generated things, whatever it might be, just that is just like thrown across the wall without any kind of consideration, whether it's communication, code, content, whatever it might be, right? Like, yep. That's what we don't want. And I say we, me and you, but I think also most people. We've seen when companies try to do like AI-generated ads or something that are clearly like low effort and they just look kind of cringy. Like, people reject those things, in like largely speaking, right? Yeah. And I think it's the same thing here. Like, you don't want to just generate something quickly, throw it over the wall as a pull request, and then, you know, that's it, right? Like, you want to engage with it, make sure it's as high quality as you can, you know, communicate about it, accept feedback, iterate on it. And then, you know, even if you do use AI, you can end up creating something great. And the point there of reviewing your own code, I think, is really crucial. And I think this is something like the more you use AI to generate your code, the more you need to focus on that. Because yep. Especially if you are a developer, I mean, everyone can make their own decisions. But me personally, I don't want my skills as a developer to go away. I don't want to, you know, get worse as being a programmer after mm-hmm. After more and more years. And like with all kind of knowledge and muscles, you know, we need to exercise them. And at least like when you're using tools to generate your code, I think it's important to read through it to fully understand it. You can ask the agent to clarify if you don't understand something. You can ask it to like rewrite it in a way that will be easier for, you know, humans to read, because that's also what we're trying to optimize for, not only for pure performance or handling all the edge cases, but also for humans to read and maintain the code. So those things, I think, become even more important as we move into this, like more and more into this AI age, that we take that additional time to review our code, ensure it has high quality, ensure that all the open questions are answered. There's good documentation that is not just word salad, but that actually means something, right? And like you said, the pull request description communication, that it feels thoughtful and human, that it doesn't, again, it's not just a wall of text generated by AI that is like technically correct, but feels just like sterile and not communicative at all. Like, I think those are things that are always worth keeping in mind when using these tools.
Yeah, and also AI tends to be extremely verbose, like adding unnecessary words to make things sound fancier than they are. That's one of the telltale signs of an AI-generated pull request. So maybe use one of those skills that like teaches the AI to be more concise. That can be a good idea. But again, do not use it to actually write the pull request message. Write those yourself. Oh, and final thing is disclose your usage of a coding agent in your pull request. I think that's also important.
Yeah.
And even important to actually say which one you used and which model you used, because I don't know about you, John, but I have slowly learned about some aspects of code, especially in Swift, which is what I use the most, but some things that like, oh, Claude tends to do this thing that I don't like. So if someone opens a pull request and says they use Claude, I will look more closely at those things. So it's important to disclose that. But another thing that AI coding agents can be really helpful for is writing test code and unit tests. And I know you have stuff to talk about that, but not necessarily AI related. So don't worry, folks. It's not a full episode about AI.
Well, that is an excellent segue, I must say. So yes, indeed, I do want to talk about unit testing on this month's episode. So it's been a little while since we talked about this topic, I feel like, and so much has changed in the world in general, in the iOS development world, since we last talked about it, which I think was several years ago at this point now. So when it comes to unit testing on Apple's platforms, some of the big things that have happened since I believe we talked about it is, first of all, we now have Swift testing instead of just XC test or, you know, other open source alternatives to writing unit tests that have existed as well, which is a really great library from Apple, and that enables us to use the power of macros, really, to like really get rid of a lot of boilerplate and create unit tests that are concise and that solves some of the kind of pain points that XC test, for example, had. And we then also now have much, much more use in most projects of async await. I think maybe when we talk, I don't remember exactly when we last talked about unit tests, but it was probably like in the early days of async await.
Yeah.
Now we have, you know, full integration of async await into Swift testing, also within XC test. But it's really, really helpful when you're writing code that relies on, you know, actors or other async code that you can unit test that pretty easily. And of course, also, you know, relating to the topic we just talked about, as we use coding agents or AI assisted, you know, tools in general, having good tests, I think, can become really crucial. And of course, a big question there also becomes, do you use AI to write your tests or do you write the tests yourself? Similar to our documentation and pull request description topic before, I think. Yeah. So let's dive right in. Let me start by asking you, Rambo, because I think when we've talked about unit testing in the past, especially in the early days of Stacktrace, I remember that you were not using unit tests perhaps that much. You were, you know, you've been focusing on being an indie developer, on, you know, writing your product and developing your products, which is completely understandable, instead of perhaps always aiming for like 100% test coverage or something. So could you just like update me and the listeners, like what's your current usage of unit tests in general in your various projects?
So it definitely increased a lot since we last spoke about it. And I think it has a lot to do first with most of my projects are quite mature, so they require a lot more maintenance work rather than huge new developments, although of course those also happen every now and then. But when you want to change something, and I think our friend of the show, Paul Hudson of Hacking with Swift, has a say that like refactoring without unit tests is just like changing code randomly. Because
right.
If you don't have unit tests and you change a lot of the code, how do you know it still works the same way it did before? And this might sound really weird for people who are not developers, if anyone who's not a developer still listens to this, but sometimes we have to change code and not change what it does. It sounds weird, but it is required sometimes because you want to add another feature or change something else, and that requires massaging the code base in a way that you can integrate something new. And if you don't have a way to automatically verify that the code does what it's supposed to do, you will introduce bugs when you do those refactorings. And I, of course, learned that the hard way, as I think most developers did. And these days I have been using it a lot more. I don't really pay attention to test coverage necessarily. And I also don't have, like, I would not say, oh, all of my products are 100% unit tested. It's not even close to that. But with more complex projects such as AirBuddy, as I've been working on the new version, which is coming out probably this next month, actually, finally, I have been adding a lot more unit tests. And when there are bug reports and I fix something, I mean, these days, I typically, if it's not one of those bug reports where it's clearly like an AppKit bug or something like that, but if it's clearly something wrong with the logic in my code, these days, before I even try to fix the bug, I will write a unit test that reproduces the bug using the underlying subsystem that is found to be the root cause of the bug. And then I will fix it, and then I have a regression test, so I do not reintroduce that bug later. And of course, another aspect is AI coding agents are really good at writing testing code. That's one of the things they're best at. And even with Swift testing, sometimes there is a bit of boilerplate because you typically need a lot of testing data, and generating that test data by hand can be very tedious and error prone. So for example, in AirBuddy, I have unit tests where I need a very long sequence of device events with very specific changes to very specific things. And if I mess that up, then the test is not going to work the way it should. So for those types of things, I do use Cody agents for the tests. And fortunately, the more recent models are no longer doing like assert true and being like, hey, the test passed. So that's good.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, yeah, you bring up some really good points there. And when it comes to testing data specifically, I think that is very crucial to get right, especially if you're unit testing something like what you mentioned that is very event driven. I think something that can help also is that if you have some mechanism in your app to record a session in some way, like if you want to, now we're getting, I would say, more into like integration tests, but I mean, that distinction doesn't really matter. I think it's all about like, how can we create automated tests for our projects, whether or not it's testing just a single unit or a single function, or if it's something that is testing like a larger flow. Of course, it's important to have both kinds of tests, but either kind is good, right? Like, yep. However we can use automation to verify that we don't cause regressions and that our code's behavior is correct is great, in my opinion. But something that I found really useful in these kinds of systems where you need to test like events and different signal processing and so on, to have a way to run like your app in a mode where it records the session in like a serializable format like JSON or something,
yep,
and then use that as resources in your unit tests where the unit test can unload that session and recreate the state and then run the tests on that. That I found to be incredibly useful, because then you are not just coming up with these events manually, like you said, which is very error prone, and you can really lead to like false positives or positive negatives, like when you're essentially testing the wrong thing. Because at the end of the day, like, writing unit tests is writing code, and that's when, you know, you can introduce bugs in your unit tests too. So keeping, yep, them simple, I think, is really key. Keeping them grounded as much as possible in the real logic that is run in production is also really important. I really try to minimize my use of mocks, for example, for that reason, because, mm-hmm, I found in some code bases that they have like everything is mockable, like with code generation or something like that. And then, you know, a unit test can just end up being like testing a bunch of mocks, and the real logic is actually barely just tested. So writing things that take like proper input output that you can test, that is like real objects or real structs and so on, I think is really important, because then you can test the real logic. And of course, sometimes you do need a mock, for example, if you want to test something that involves like the network or something. And that's when like being able to record those real responses, like use the real data that you get in production, but stored as a resource file in your test bundle, can be incredibly useful, because then you strike a nice balance between you have a mock, you have written as little code as possible to set that mock up, so you know there's not that many risks there that you have written the wrong thing, and you are then testing like a real response that you would get from your server. It's just like in a pre-saved offline format, so you don't have to actually call the network in your unit test, which of course you don't want to do. So yeah, I think those are some things that are really good to keep in mind when writing unit tests or integration tests or automated tests in general.
Yeah, I have a pretty cool system in AirBuddy, for example, where I can, in debug builds, export the entire device tree that's currently present in the app as a property list or a JSON file and individual device data. And also a thing I called Orange Box, because, you know, airplane black boxes, they're actually orange, so I call it Orange Box. Mm-hmm. And it's a system that can record individual Bluetooth packets in order and timed so that they can be replayed in unit tests with the exact timing that they happen in real life, so that I can, in fact, test those really weird edge cases and hardware timing things that are very difficult to reproduce with synthetic data. And I totally agree with you about the mocks as well. To use a coding agent-ism, I like to mock the seams. So like the places where your logic meets external things, for example, hardware, or like you mentioned, network, or even things like maybe you have a thing that abstracts user defaults and preferences in general, that might be mocked because you don't want to touch real user defaults on your machine or on the CI server. So yeah, I definitely agree about being careful with what you mock.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, these days when we have Swift testing, I think that is also something that helps with just writing more unit tests, because it has this much more lightweight syntax, and it's easier to just like get a test up and running quickly, I think. Where before we would have to create like a test case that would be a subclass of XCTest case if you were using XCTest. And then you always had this problem of, you know, you would have to have in most cases that these like explicitly unwrapped or implicitly unwrapped optionals, because the test case would be instantiated separately, and then your tests run by calling test functions on that test case, and then you could accidentally end up sharing state, because if your state wasn't reset properly in that class, you know, all sorts of problems like that. And with Swift testing, we create a struct, and then we can initialize that struct however we want, and we can set properties on it, and we can just have those as normal Swift properties. We just write @test to annotate a specific test function. We have the expect macro that automatically picks up comments on the code as well, which I love. And you can write like a freeform expression in there. You have things like require to get optionals that really shouldn't be nil, but they might be an optional technically. So you can verify that as well without having to, again, do force unwrapping or any sorts of things like that. With async await, you can easily test like async calls as well. And one thing that I've been meaning to write an article about, perhaps I will very soon, is I've been using async let quite a lot in unit tests. Ooh. Where if you want to do an operation and then later you want to get the result of that, but you don't want to block on it because you want to do some other things in unit tests while that operation happens, this is a great use case for async let, where you could say, you know, async let some name equals an operation. And then that doesn't await at that point, but then you can do other things. And then later when you want to perform your assertion, that's when you can await the result and then do an #expect on that, right? Yeah. So it creates this like quite really nice flow where you can have a bunch of tests that are not necessarily like, you know, 50 lines per test function of all setup code and stuff. It's much more concise. And I really think this is very important for unit tests, that it's like easy to read and parse mentally, especially if you have a large number of tests. So you can see like what are the different conditions that are being tested here. And I usually also go to the effort of creating like utility functions and so on for my tests, besides like the kind of recording systems we talked about earlier. So that if I see that, oh, in these five unit tests, I have to create this kind of mock data or stub data that is similar, I create like an external function for that. Usually it's like I create an extension on the type with a static function that is like stub some name. So if I have a user type, I do extension user, and then I do like stub with name, and that returns me a user struct, for example, with a given name or a given ID or whatever it might be. And then I can call that in within each of my tests, so I don't have to repeat that same setup code, which again lowers the line count, makes it easier to just see what each test is actually testing, and makes it easier to maintain. And connecting that back to the AI discussion we had earlier, if you're using AI to generate your tests, which, you know, there are pros and cons to doing that. I think there are some advantages to saying you write the tests manually and then you ask the AI to write the implementation, or you have the AI write the implementation and you write the tests. Or for some people, you might like to have AI do everything, right? And then you verify it. It again depends on how you integrate AI into your workflow. But I think, you know, for most people, and definitely for me, 100% for me, is that if I'm doing a code review and I have a unit test file that is like 500 lines and full of complicated setup code, it's hard to review. It's hard to focus on it. Like it's just, I start skimming it and I'm like, it's probably good enough if the tests pass, right? And that can be really bad, especially if it's all generated and it has all sorts of problems, or it's human authored, but it has all sorts of problems. So again, it's a really good thing to keep our code like easy to read, easy to parse for humans, and well structured. And that's something I always try to keep in mind when writing unit tests as well.
One thing about coding agents and unit tests is that for code bases that have really good test coverage, you are at a better position to have a coding agent change things in your code base and be able to verify that at least the things that were already there haven't been broken. Of course, you have to verify that it didn't change the unit tests themselves, unless it's actually needed. But right. If you ask it to, I don't know, refactor something or update something to use a newer API or Swift feature or something like that, and you do have unit tests for it, and they are still passing after the change, then it's very likely that the change did not introduce new bugs. But then that will depend, of course, on having a significant coverage, because there's always the edge case that you forgot to test. And of course, Murphy's Law says that that's where the bug will be introduced.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so I think it's time to wrap up this episode of Stack Trace. So lots of fun things that we were able to talk about this month. And I want to repeat that if you, the listener, want us to talk about some specific topic, then feel free to reach out to us either via Blue Sky, via Mastodon, or via email. We love to get suggestions for topics from our listeners. Or if there's anything you would like us to dive deeper into on a future episode, likewise, just reach out. We'll be happy to get that feedback. But that's it for this month. So we'll be back next month with a new episode. Until then, say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.